I have often recommended that people who are serious about following the liturgical life, I recommended that they or you read the readings the night before. Just not a deep study, but just an introduction, so that when it comes time to pray and ponder the word, there's already something in our minds. So I like that practice. And anyway, I bring my anima away to my bedroom because I look at it before I go to sleep. When I woke up this morning, this was the first thing I saw, the Anubhav Way, and what struck me was the beautiful painting on the front cover, which is the encounter of the prodigal son with his merciful father. That was last Sunday's gospel. So for some reason it jumped out at me. It is quite a painting. It's an artistic attempt to capture not just that moment of encounter, but the whole scene of what the father has in mind for this son of his, because the servants are there. If you look at this, the servants are already there. I mean, the young man just arrived and he's still kneeling there, and already the servant is there with the robe on a tray and the sandals, and then there's another servant holding up a ring, and then on the other side there's the fatted calf already, and right behind him there's a servant with a, looks like a hatchet or something, ready to slaughter the, so it's as if to imply not only was the father waiting for the return of his son, but the whole household was waiting in preparation for this moment. Kind of a beautiful meditation. This is famous painting, not as famous as Rembrandt's version, but still, this is Bartolome Esteban Murillo, painting from 1667. Okay, now. So that's first impression, just popped into my head as I woke up this morning. But then I recalled the readings, and the readings today have, in the first reading, this interchange between God and Moses about what to do with the sinful people. And then the gospel, Jesus giving a whole series of testimonies or evidence, as if he were on trial already, showing how many different witnesses testify on his behalf. So after this very appealing vision of what God is really like, all of a sudden the first reading gives what seems to be a contradiction to that vision, this wrathful God just out to destroy his people. And then in the gospel, a kind of involved and difficult passage that doesn't immediately grab us because it's a lot of, sounds like legal language. But of course, it's not that way. Those impressions, that's what pondering the word is about, right? Getting past those impressions so that we can see what God is really saying. So in this first reading today, it's not a different God than the one Jesus reveals in the parable of the prodigal. It's the same God who has no desire to condemn his own people, but a God who is just. So how can this be conveyed? Because we think that when justice is applied to wrongdoing, it's punishment and it's wrath and it's destruction and it's a bad thing. So our kind of default position is to already misread works of justice, at least when they're applied to us. Now, when we're just, that's a different thing, because we're the ones deciding who's in the wrong and who should be punished. But when we're in the wrong and we're getting punished, we think that's a bad thing. So here's the scene. Moses has been up on the mountain, right, for 40 days, and the people have become depraved. As God himself says, your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, they have become depraved. They've fallen into the grave sin of idolatry. So then he says to Moses, step aside now, and I'm just going to blast them. I'm going to let my blazing wrath flare up against them. And Moses is the one who said, no, wait a minute, don't let your blazing wrath rise up and wipe them out. Just think about this for a minute. So we get this impression, and this is the lasting impression many people have, that Moses is the good guy here and God is the bad guy. It's like watching arm wrestling, you know, who's going to win here? It's Moses against God. Moses against God. Is God going to wipe out his people? Is he so angry that he can't be stopped? Or is Moses going to overcome him and get him to back down? A little bit dramatic, but it works. And Moses, it looks on the surface, wins, and God backs down. He loses. Now, that's how it looks, but I want to say there's more to this than that first impression, because in fact, the bad guy here is the people. The sinners here are the people who have fallen into idolatry and who have, well, as it says, left the right path. They turned away from the way I pointed out to them, the way of salvation, the way to the promised land. The people are the bad guys here, and Moses and God are on the same side. That is the side of justice and mercy. So sin is one thing. Justice and mercy are in God's hands, which to us seem like two different things, but are not different in God. And so what's displayed here, and the more you think about this, the more beautiful it is, the wrath of God is the right response of justice in the face of wrongdoing. It's not the same as saying, I don't care what happens and anyone can do whatever they want because I'm merciful. No, I do care because I hate it when people leave the right path. It's terrible for them. That kind of behavior is going to ruin my good plan for them. That's the wrath of God. He doesn't want that to happen. And he's not intent on blazing up against them. And the very fact that he tells Moses about it is the proof. If he wanted to destroy them, he would have just done it. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he tells Moses because he wants to include in his plan of salvation the human person. God, who has every right to work independently of us, he created us and he can do what he wants, he's constantly drawing us into his plan, so that we recognize not only our own wrongdoing and we repent, but they can also recognize that God is on our side. Moses here, who's been led into the inner circle, he knows the mind of God. He says, well, okay, I mean, yes, these people are they've done a terrible thing. He doesn't excuse them. Because that would be false. It is evil. Idolatry is a very grave sin. He doesn't excuse them. What does he do? He takes the argument that you, God, are the one who chose them. as if Moses is saying, you led your people out of Egypt, and Moses says, no, you led your people out of Egypt. They're both saying, these are your people, and you're the one who's responsible for them. And they're both right. Who led the people out of Egypt? God or Moses? Both. God led them out, but he used Moses. You see, he included Moses in his plan of salvation. Now, Moses, of course, is not only the mediator and the lawgiver, he's also a forerunner or a type of Christ. He prepares us for the ultimate mediator and the ultimate lawgiver and the ultimate intercessor for us, Jesus Christ. That's where we see, in fact, on the cross, is where we see how this really works. How does the justice of God and the mercy of God, how do they both win? And how does sin lose? Well, it's not just that God says, I don't care, forget about it. Because that would minimize our dignity as if what we do doesn't make any difference. No, he says, no, I do care. I care so much, I'm going to ask my son to make the sacrifice that will justify them. In other words, justice will be served, but not by the guilty. An innocent victim is going to take their place and manifest my divine mercy. This is what's behind the scene here. So it's not bad God against good Moses. It's the good God involving Moses and, by extension, us, in his good plan. So that's a preparation for Jesus. Now let's get to Jesus and the gospel here. Jesus is using a kind of complicated means to get the people to recognize that he's on their side and that he's the manifestation of the mercy of God. So he says, all these different people testify on my behalf, but you're missing the testimony. It's if you don't listen, you're not listening. Look at John the Baptist testifies on my behalf. The works that I do testify about on my behalf. The Father testifies on my behalf. The Scriptures testify on my behalf. Moses himself testifies on my behalf. If you would only accept Moses, if you believe Moses, you'd believe me, because he wrote about me. You see what's being done here? The extraordinary way that God was including Moses in his plan of salvation. It was nothing by comparison to the much more extraordinary way God is including us in the plan. Here is Jesus saying, "Oh, I'm the new Moses. I'm the mediator. I'm the answer to this problem of your stubbornness and idolatry and sinfulness, but you're not getting it. And I won't force salvation on you. You have to make this step of acceptance, of belief, of faith. If you don't believe, if you refuse to believe, then you won't get the benefit of mercy or justice. You just get the consequences of your own sin. So, how does this connect to this picture that I started with? Here's a God the Father revealed as the loving, merciful God who's welcoming his son. But how is that love communicated to us, and how can it be done in such a way that doesn't make our wrongdoing, doesn't minimize the significance of our own wrongdoing? Well, that's what we see here. Jesus is the key. Jesus is the new Moses. He's the one who makes it possible for us to face the reality of our sin without being destroyed by the wrath of God. It's not that God is intent on destroying us. Sin is already destroying us and will destroy us if we don't turn from it. Okay, Lenten journey, here it all is. It's another opportunity for us to reflect on, yes, our sin, our what's the word for it? Our complete unworthiness to be part of this, and God's unchanging conviction that we have to be part of it. He wants us to be saved. He'll do anything to save us, except force us. He won't drag us into the promised land. So that means we have to respond to him. So this is the Moses Mass. I think that I say that. This is sometimes referred to as the Moses Mass, because Moses, very prominent in the first reading, Moses in the Psalm, who withstood God in the breach to turn back his destructive wrath, and then Moses as one who testifies to Jesus as a forerunner, just like John the Baptist or any of the prophets, a forerunner to Jesus. And the key thing is, welcome those forerunners, those who testify, so that you get the benefit of the arrival of the Savior.